I want to begin by telling my favorite monastic story. Some of you have probably heard it, some haven't. Story of a monk who was really struggling. And his life was just unbearable. You know, we can appreciate that. Some of us feel that way sometimes. And he finally went to God and he said, "I can't bear the cross anymore. The cross you've given me is too hard. I can't do it. Please give me another one." And so God, in his grace, said, "Okay, I'll let you pick." And he took a monk into a room filled with crosses. Huge room filled with crosses. And there were big crosses. And there were crosses with nails sticking out of them, you know. Heavy oak crosses. And he looked all over the room and he was getting depressed. They're all so big. And then he sees in the corner a little tiny gold cross with precious jewels. And of course he knows that that big one with all the nails was the one God had been having him carry. So he walked immediately away from that. He picked up this little cross and he said, "Lord, I'll take this one." And God looked down at him and said, "That's the one you have." The marital cross. In this, our last lecture, I want to discuss with you just a little bit, what is this cross? What is the cross that is the marital cross, and how do we carry it? And to help us in answering this, I want to use a presentation by St. Theophan the Recluse, which, if you want to read about it later, it's in his book Kindling the Divine Spark, chapter 6, called Erecting the Inner Cross. And it's significant to me that this chapter was preached on the Feast of the Elevation of the Cross. Because the fact that the chapter was preached on that feast links it to marriage. Did you know that one of the marital feasts is the elevation of the cross? Because who found the cross? Constantine and Helen. And Constantine and Helen are a significant part of the wedding service itself. In the prayer right before the crowning, the priest prays, "Let that gladness come upon them which the blessed Helen had when she found the precious cross." And isn't that interesting that the crowning would be linked to the finding of the cross? Because that's what those two people are going to find. And then the closing commemorations, which are very significant. You know, the church never does anything haphazardly. There's meaning to all of these things. And in the closing commemoration, when the priest requests God to have mercy on the couple through the prayers, significantly certain saints are chosen. The holy, glorious, all laudable apostles, we know why. And then comes the mention of the holy, God-crowned kings Constantine and Helen, equal to the apostles. You see, there's this linking between the elevation of the cross and the finding of the cross, and our own marriage. So St. Theophan, on this feast, tries to answer the question, what is the cross? Now, he is writing specifically of the monastic cross. And what I want to do is take what he says about the monastic cross and drop those parts that apply to monasticism and bring it over and teach you about the marital cross. And it's interesting because he starts and he says, what we must first understand about the cross is that the Golgotha of this cross is our heart. Our heart is where we must erect this cross. And this means that to make our marriages work, the place to start is me, not you. And I don't know about you, I always fix my marriage by talking about you. Because, you know, if my wife was different, we'd have a great marriage. Especially on those days when she does something to upset me. I always instinctively, and it's so easy to fix the marriage by changing her. Have you ever noticed that? I'm the world's greatest counselor when it comes to my marriage. Because she always needs to change and I'll be happy and then everything will be wonderful. And I bet you you're great counselors too, because, you know, you can fix your spouse one way and the other. And if it doesn't work the first time, you'll come up with a second list of what they need to do to fix it. Whereas what St. Theophan says is no. Start with you. And start with your heart. Because if your heart isn't right, you can change all you want on the outside and it isn't going to fix your marriage. Because what ruins your marriage is your heart. It's what ruins everything else in your life. It's what's wrong in your heart. For as Jesus reminds us, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So then he says, having decided that we're going to erect this cross in our heart, so we'll pretend the ground here is the heart, right? I didn't draw this, by the way, you can tell. My cross barely looks like a cross. So we had Father Luke Dingman draw the cross that actually looks like a cross. He isolates three parts to the cross. He says, first of all, there's the lower part, which breaks the ground of the heart and implants the cross in it. Then there's the upper part. So you have the lower part and the upper part, and then you have the horizontal part. Okay, so he says there's three parts to this cross. The lower part that goes into the ground, the upper cross, upper part, and then the horizontal part. He labels the lower part as self-denial. The upper part he labels as patience. The horizontal part he labels as obedience. Three parts to the cross: self-denial, patience, and obedience. This is the marital cross. To carry the marital cross is to constantly practice self-denial. Now, I've already mentioned to you the words of Jesus where he says, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself daily, take up his cross, and follow me. Now, I had always read that, and one of the things I'm hoping that I'm doing for you without doing it for you publicly, and now I'm going to do it for you publicly, is I'm helping you to take your marriage and think about your marriage within the context of your spirituality. Because most of us divorced our life from our spirituality. You know, the spiritual things are the things we do in church by ourselves. And then we go out and we live in the world. What I want to show you is when we hear Jesus saying, deny yourself, what do you instinctively think of? You think of that steak you wanted to have last Friday night. Right? Okay, and there's nothing wrong with that. That is self-denial. But self-denial also applies to the movie she wanted to watch at 6 p.m. Monday evening. When the 49ers were playing, right? That's self-denial. And that makes a steak seem easy. St. Dorotheus of Gaza says, and I remember when I read this, I picked up this book, and after I read it, I regretted picking it up. You ever pick up a book, it's so good you hate it, you know? It's so good. I picked up, he has this big thing, St. Dorotheus of Gaza, 6th century ascetic, and he's wonderful, you should read him. He's the guy who always fell asleep and slept through church. So everybody loves him, you know, because he missed church so many times because he was such a heavy sleeper. He used to pay people to come wake him up. He did. He had two people. It wasn't just enough for one monk to do it. He had to pay two monks. One to get him, and then he'd fall back to sleep, and the other monk would get him. Our kind of guy, right? And he wrote, self-indulgence is the root of all vice. And then he goes on to say, let us learn to cut off our desires For nothing helps man so much as to cut off self-will, for thereby a man prepares the way for nearly all the virtues. Self-indulgence is the root of your problems. And then he comes up with this really great idea. He says, you know what? It's really hard to deny yourself. It takes a lot of work. So what I want you guys to do is start practicing it all the time. And he comes up with these neat suggestions. He says, your thoughts say to you, go over there and see what's there. Don't go. Your thought comes to you, I wonder what my wife is cooking for dinner. Don't ask. Your thought comes to you, I'm sort of making it contemporary. Your thought comes to you, I want some ice cream tonight. Don't eat it. Just practice random acts of self-denial. I'm coming up with great slogans, aren't I? Look at that. You guys are going to have bumper stickers all over the place. Be a martyr, get married, practice random acts of self-denial, and then they'll commit you, you know? But he says if you practice this, now he's writing in a monastic setting, but he says if you practice this, he says you will come in a matter of time to make a habit of self-denial. And you will find self-denial is easy, and if you find self-denial is easy, you will find the kingdom and you will find all virtue. So he says, start with the little things. Just denying yourself. And over time, you will accustom yourself to a life of self-denial, and you will find that everything God requires of you will be easy. And to do what God wants will no longer be self-denial, it will be your joy. And isn't that what we all want? To come to Lent and go, yes. I'm not there yet, you know. I come to Lent and go, oh, you know, 40 days and counting, you know. It's interesting, as an aside, there's a wonderful story of a man who went to visit a monk in Finland. And he said, what is the key to spiritual maturity? And he says the key to spiritual maturity is to accept whatever comes today and be happy with it without looking for tomorrow. And he says, I bet, it was during Lent, and he says, I bet you can't wait for Pascha. And the guy says, yeah, I can't wait. He says, I don't care. Today is Lent. This is God's will for me today. I'm happy. When Pascha comes, I'll rejoice in Pascha because it'll be God's will for me then. But I don't spend my life wanting and wishing. I accept. That's spiritual maturity. That's self-denial. And St. Dorothea says you don't get there, you know. You don't get to the point where you enjoy Lent by waiting for Lent to come around. You do it by practicing random acts of self-denial. And I start to think, you know what? That's marriage. Marriage is wonderful because there are thousands of ways to practice random acts of self-denial in marriage. I mean, this is it. Every day, I get chances of denying myself. Let me give you an example. I know it's going to happen tomorrow, so I'm priming myself for tomorrow. Sunday afternoon, I am always beat and tired. Absolutely exhausted. All I want is a glass of water in the left hand, a chair somewhere else, and quiet. My wife is bored to tears on Sunday afternoon. Don't know why. It's just every Sunday she sits there, I sit down to relax, and she gives me that look that says, what are we doing? Because I can't stand to be in this house anymore. Because I've been in this house with four kids all week, and I want to get out. And I'm sitting down going, I don't want to see anybody. I don't want to go anywhere. I want to relax, right? Every Sunday it's the same thing. And tomorrow it's even worse because my in-laws are in and she wants to go to San Francisco. Yeah. What a perfect opportunity to deny myself. And to find my salvation and to say, what would you like to do? Where would you like to go? You see, perfect. God made opportunity to find salvation. On a Sunday afternoon when I'm beaten tired and I want to relax. And of course, this is but one of many. Self-denial in your marriage can be as simple as watching her movie instead of your football game. Or it can be as major as not pushing for sex when you know that she is tired. And that's big time self-denial. It can be as simple as getting up to get her something to drink instead of wanting her to get up and get you something to drink. And can be as major as not saying that comment about her mother when she drives you crazy again. Just controlling self-denial. You know we do that in marriage. We say those little comments all the time. They do. You know those ones, right? Your spouse does something that drives you crazy. And if you've been married at any time, you don't have to go into a long thing. You have to say like three words. And they hear that long lecture you used to give. That's why married people can talk to each other in such a short period of time. And it is the up, and then, you know, there are some times when in marriage God just gives you zingers. You know, you can just give them and bam, they're right there. Actually, God doesn't give them to you. Satan does. So it is really hard to practice self-denial and not say, I told you so. I knew that was going to happen. See, if you had listened to me, right? I could have told you if you had asked, right? Self-denial. It can be as simple as cooking his favorite meal, or it can be as major as picking up his clothes, which he left on the floor again without complaining. Each one of these moments is a salvific moment. A moment in which I can find salvation by denying myself. A moment in which I can cut off my own will and I can deny myself and I can follow after Christ. That's what it means for me to follow after Christ, is to deny myself and serve my wife. You know, and we get these wonderfully, you know, idealistic, oh, I just wish I could go as a missionary and be butchered by the cannibals, you know, right? You know, oh, wouldn't that be wonderful? Ah, but I can't do that, so would you give me something to drink? That's how we do it. That's how we live. Instead of saying, you know, getting yourself something to drink, let alone her something to drink, that's being butchered by the cannibals for you. And forget these highfalutin ideas of doing something big for God, because that was the way we used to think. Now we're Orthodox. We do little things for God all the time. And that counts as a big thing. Deny yourself. There's an interesting troparion to the venerable ones that we sing. In you, O Mother, or in you, O Father, is restored the image of God. For you carried your cross and followed Christ. You taught by your deeds how to spurn the body, for it passes away, and how to value the soul, for it never shall die. Wherefore your soul is forever in happiness with the angels. That's a troparion for married saints. I made it so it doesn't count. Don't go singing it tomorrow. But that's exactly what marriage gives us the opportunity. How to deny our bodies by serving each other so that our soul may forever be in happiness with the angels. So to carry the marital cross is to practice self-denial. Anyone who's married not know what this means? Is there anybody here who can't think of one example when you could do this? Anybody? Because if you're not, I'll spend some time with you. Actually, I'll spend some time with your spouse. They'd help me a lot. All right? I think we understand that one. All right? Secondly, St. Theophan says, to carry the marital cross is to practice patience. St. Theophan defines patience as a firmness to stand in your intention so that no obstacles, discontentment, or labors can make you waver. It's a firmness to do what you have set out to do, regardless of how many obstacles there are, regardless of how tired you are, and regardless of how much work it is. That's patience. Now, if you're familiar at all with the writings of the spiritual fathers, you know how important this concept of patience is in their counsels. Over and over again, if you read the monastic literature, you'll find that they tell monks, stay where you are. How many times have you read that? Stay where you are. Don't look for a better place. You know, they talk about these monks who go from monastery to monastery finding the best place to be saved. And all the spirits, oh, don't do that. Stay where you are. There is no such thing as a better place for you, because the problem is when you get there, you're there. And it stops being a better place for you, because you're the problem. You know, it's always, they always say, if you found a perfect church, leave, because you'd ruin it. Don't look for a more spiritual place, they say. You can be saved right where you are. So plant your feet in cement and don't leave yourself. But know that Satan's going to come and he is going to distract you. Know that Satan is going to come and he's going to tempt you. That's what they say. Know that he's going to discourage you and say it's worthless and you're not making any effort and you need to leave. But don't listen to him. Do not leave yourself. That's what you read, right? Anybody read that over and over again? Well, I would like you today to think of your marriage as your monastic cell. And I have the same exact advice for you. Do not leave your cell. One struggle that almost all married couples go through, if you've been married, is this sense of boredom. You've been married for a while. It's same old, same old. The passion is gone, either because you're too tired or you're too distracted, you know. All of those visions you had for marriage when you got married, you know, that you were going to float off into the sunset, you know, while the music was getting played. You found out that that was a lie because the tape recorder broke and the CD player didn't work, you know, and there's no music. And the sunset is, you're not floating, you know, you're in one of those paddle boats going against the current. You get bored in marriage. And this boredom often turns into bondage. You know, we often joke about the old iron chains. Where did that joke come from? People feel that way. As Orthodox Christians, we must see behind this boredom and behind this sense of bondage the hand of Satan. Because if you read any of the spiritual literature, you know that Satan is very good at creating and enhancing feelings of boredom, bondage, and discouragement. It's the demon of the noonday in the monastic literature, which they say is the most difficult demon of all. And Satan is very good at suggesting exciting alternatives. How many, I mean, it breaks my heart, but, you know, adultery is a real problem in today's world. And I know of so many men who have walked right into the trap of Satan because they weren't thinking. Because he does it every time, you know? A business trip is coming up and you have a big fight with your wife before you leave. Or a business trip is coming up and you get so busy the week before you leave that you don't spend any time together and you feel lonely when you leave. And you're beat and tired when you get where you're going and you meet someone. I know of so many men who have walked right into that because they didn't see the hand of Satan. Setting up a scenario in which you would consider something that in your right mind you would never consider. That is the work of Satan. And what it will require from us is patience. Patience to endure those difficult times of marriage, which can sometimes last an eternity. At least it seems that way. You know those times when for whatever reason it just isn't clicking. And you're at each other, you know, and the kids have decided that this is their month to drive you crazy, you know. And the bank has decided that this is the month to foreclose. And Satan has decided that this is the month to ruin you, and it's the same month. Patience. There's this wonderful story of a monk who went to his abbot and he said, "I'm out of here." And the abbot, "Ooh, wait a minute, let's just talk about this a little bit." And he said, "Why do you want to leave?" He said, "Listen, Father, I'm a cultured man, and I live with a bunch of imbeciles." And the abbot goes, "What do you mean?" He said, "Look, I'm in my cell. They come in and use my things without asking. I go to dinner. They burp. They're slobs. I go to church. I cover my ears. They can't sing, even with the world's greatest choir director. I'm out of here." And the abbot was very wise, and he said to the monk, "Can you give me 3 months?" And the monk said, "All right." And he says, the abbot says to the monk, "Take out a little piece of paper about this big and write on it these words, 'I will endure this for Jesus.' And anytime anything happens that bothers you, anytime they burp at dinner or use your stuff or they can't sing, pull that little piece of paper out and just read it to yourself. Over and over again, 'I will endure this for Jesus.' And come back in 3 months, and if you still want to leave, you have my blessing to go." 3 months later, abbot calls him in and says, "So do you want to leave?" And he says, "Why would I want to leave this wonderful monastery?" And the abbot goes, wait a minute, did they stop coming in your room?" And the monk thinks and he says, "No, you know what, they still come and use my stuff." He says, "Well, did they stop being uncouth at dinner?" And the monk thinks for a minute and says, "You know what, they still do it." He says, "Did they sing any better?" And the monk thinks, "You know what, they don't sing any better. I guess I changed." Because he exercised patience. Wouldn't that be wonderful in our marriages if we adopted that? "I will endure this for Jesus." St. Theophan says, "This will require the suppression of almost all feeling in endurance." And anybody who's gone through those times know that you have to suppress just about every feeling. You know, you start with anger, right? And then they start rolling. Anger is Satan's. Once Satan gets you angry, it's all downhill from there, right? To be patient requires a change in orientation from a feeling-dominated and feeling-directed life. To be patient is to be a martyr. And yet, one of the things, so funny, I tell the stories of the martyrs to the kids all the time, and they almost always know what's going to happen. So they say, "Did they get beheaded?" I mean, when I'm starting, "All right, I want to know the end. Did they get beheaded?" And I'll often say, "Yes." He said, "Well, how much did they have to go through first?" Because if you read the lives of the martyrs, there's this pattern. They go through all of these tortures, and they don't die. And in fact, the lives of the saints for today, at the end, if you read the life of the saints for today, they're crying out, the bears come out to kill them, and the bears won't kill them, so they're trying to get the bears to kill them. They're shaking them up, you know? "Come on, come on!" And the bears are laying down, and they're kicking them and everything, and the bears won't kill them, and finally they just get beheaded, you know? You read almost all the martyrs are the same. They get this long period of torment, and then they get beheaded and they go to heaven. And I often thought, why don't they just behead them first? You know, it would have been so much easier. But if I have to die, beheading's not a bad way to go. You know, I mean, I'm sure it looks bad coming down, but it's over. Right? It's the getting raked, you know, with nails part that drives me crazy. And it's the hanging by my toenails that I wouldn't like. And it's the bear that licks me before it eats me that I wouldn't like. Beheading sounds good after all that stuff. But that's not the way that we become martyrs. Martyrdom requires patience. There was a verse on the glory last night for the saints of today, which really struck me. The verse on the glory said, "As true soldiers of Christ, you renounce the pleasures here below. Taking up your cross, you followed after Christ through manifold torments without denying him before the judges. Thus the angels brought you your rewards as victors. Your heads are crowned and your souls comforted. You joined the great joy of the wedding banquet. And I thought to myself, you know what? This could be sung of those who endure in marriage. As true soldiers of Christ, you renounced the pleasures here below. Taking up your cross, you followed after Christ through manifold torments without denying him before the judges, the watching world. Thus the angels brought you your rewards as victors. Your heads are crowned and your souls comforted. You joined the great joy of the wedding banquet. That's what it's all about. And let me tell you, to stay true to your marriage vows in today's world is to be a martyr. Never has it been easier. Never has it been easier for a person to break his marital vows. I mean, just think about how many options there are. And I'm not just talking about breaking the marriage vows by having adultery. There's other ways to break the marriage vows. To stay true and faithful is to endure, and that's what God calls of us. Thirdly, to carry the marital cross is to practice obedience. And yes, here I am speaking to both husbands and wives. Because before Paul tells wives to submit to their husbands, he tells everyone to submit to everyone else. Verse 21 of Ephesians 5 says, "Submit to one another in the fear of the Lord." And what is obedience? How would you define obedience? Submitting my will to the will of another. Obedience in marriage is saying to your spouse, "Your wish is my command." Now, I'm very good at saying to my spouse, "My wish is your command." That's my usual way of speaking. And I operate on that assumption that that is true, and then I get mad when it's not. Obedience is to look to your spouse and to look for ways of submitting your will to their will. Now, all the fathers agree obedience is necessary for salvation. I must learn how to obey in order to be saved. And your marriage is a perfect place to start. As I was reflecting on this, there was an interesting little article written by Matushka Ann Lardis about this principle of bringing obedience, and it's really quite funny, so I thought I'd share with you and then a couple comments. She says that we need to start obeying. And she said, "I got started on this idea of practicing obedience in little things in my marriage because on a whim I decided to ask my husband what he wanted for supper one Friday instead of just deciding what's good for us. I suggested that I'd cook lentils, which idea he liked, but he said, 'Please, could you not put too many carrots in?'" And then she says, "Cooked carrots are a sort of marital barometer for us. I believe in them, he detests them. I slip them into everything on the grounds that they're good for us and make our eyes stronger. When I'm mad, I put lots of them into everything. When I'm happy, I present the carrots grated and raw the way he likes. One time when he was 4 hours late getting home and hadn't been able to call, I presented him with a 14-ounce bag of frozen carrots stalled in a fork when he asked about dinner. It was only the crestfallen look on his face as he attempted out of hunger and love to eat them that made me relent and cook a real meal. And so when asked to go easy on the carrots, I thought I had my first real test of the theory. Because there wasn't a carrot in the house. It's not like we hadn't bought any. I had purchased a bag of them the day before, and now I couldn't find it anywhere. And so rather than go shopping so late in the day, just to please him, I made the lentils without a single carrot in the pot. I'd not seen Father George that happy in a long time. Such a small thing, I thought, for me to be so stubborn over." As an aside, how about the things you're stubborn over in your marriage? First year of my marriage, my wife and I had a running fight for 7 months over where to put the ketchup. Because my family always put the ketchup in the refrigerator. And her family always put the ketchup out of the refrigerator. And so we just went back and forth, putting the refrigerator where we wanted it, and getting mad when it wasn't there when we went to look again, putting the ketchup. I mean, it's true. We fought about that for 7 months. And finally, I woke up one day and said, this is stupid. Then she says, the next Sunday, a Saturday, Father George had a baptism but needed some clothing. I love to shop. He hates shopping, so I volunteered to buy it for him and told him about all the places it would be fun to check out, both at the mall and in the new shopping plaza. He said, why don't you go to Walmart? It would be cheaper and you'd find it faster. I didn't want to go to Walmart. I wanted to go to the mall. I didn't want to waste a perfectly good trip to stores on men's clothing. But when I opened the refrigerator looking for a way to formulate my argument, there staring me in the face was the bag of carrots. So I went to Walmart. At the rack of pants next to me, two men were speaking. I listened a little harder. They were speaking Russian. So I reached in, got out a card, introduced myself, and told them where the church was. Turns out they're new here with the Russian Space Federation, and we're looking for a church. Coincidence? Maybe, but I'm not betting on it. And so I have a proposal. Married people have an advantage in this, since every spouse has something she or he really doesn't want to do. Think of the things you really don't want to do that would make your spouse so happy. You know, the one that hurts just like when the dentist touches the ice to just the right part of the first tooth and you've diagnosed the problem. We have those things in our marriage, you know. Now, husbands may say that they shouldn't obey their wives, that this isn't what St. Paul said. Granted, St. Paul says that men should love their wives as Christ loves the church. So respond to your wife's request the way you want Christ to answer your prayers, saying yes to what is good for her and no reluctantly to anything that would hurt her. So in other words, make the decision not on the basis of what you want or don't want, but on what's good for her. If it seems that her requests are just a little trivial, look through the Book of Needs. Don't we pray to God over things that must look trivial to Him? But God, to strengthen our faith and show His love, grants them. And so if you do the things your wife requests, whom are you really obeying? Think about that. Obedience. This then is how we find salvation in our marriages: self-denial, patience, and obedience. Very quickly, you might ask, what kind of marriage is this? It's a real winner, right? Get married, deny yourself, be patient, and obey for the rest of your life. But what we learn if we live this life is that every one of these has a hidden joy. Each one of these virtues, which seems so stern, has an inner side which is alive and joyful. If you can practice self-denial, you will be filled with joy. If you practice patience, you will find developing in you a hope and a heaven orientation that you didn't know was possible. If you practice obedience, you will find developing in you love. The love that endures, which means it's not a love which has its source in this world, but it's a love which has its source in God. In the refrigerator. She's much more kind and gracious and obedient than I am, so.
In many men's books and articles, you would read that the key to being happy is to setting your priorities. Like God number one, your wife number two, right. And I'm a single person, so this is like a major inquirer's class for me. Okay. But with that idea, it always seemed like looking ahead to that in the future, that would be separate. But now what you're saying is is that to love your wife or your future wife sacrificially and as a martyr would be the ultimate expression of loving God.
Absolutely.
So you couldn't really love your wife more than God, could you?
Absolutely. You've got it. You've got it. That's it. That's it. That's it. I love God by loving my wife. You know, as an example of this, there's a guy in my church, and I won't tell you who it is, but he really was struggling, and he loves to do prostrations. Okay, he loves to go in and just prostrate. Boom, boom, boom. That's his prayer life, prostrations. And yet, you know, his wife would get so mad because he always went and did his prostrations right after dinner, which is when all the dishes needed to be washed and the kids watched. And so finally I said to him, your prostrations are the dishes in the sink. Okay? It's 100 if you finish. Because to him, that was his asceticism, was to do the dishes. And that was harder than any 100 prostrations he had ever done in his life. And that's exactly the point. We tend to divorce these things, and they're not divorced. We love God by loving our wives, and we love God together, praying together, fasting together, coming to church together, receiving the Eucharist together, raising our kids together, enduring together. Yeah.
Then you did answer my question about Simon. His wife must have been in agreement.
Yes.
Correct.
That's right. Okay. That's right. And they both followed Christ. And that's what brings us ultimately together, is that we follow Christ together. That's right. Good. Yeah.
I think this would go really well with your children as well. As a good example in a marriage, but also just serving them.
Right.
But I have 5 children, and picking up all their shoes, I mean, that's all I would do all the time.
Right.
Where do you break up showing these things versus responsibility, let's say, and with your children?
One of the answers that I would have for that is that you're responsible to train your children, but you're not responsible to train your husband. I mean, there's a difference. When we're responsible for the training, then we can say, look, you know, you need to clean this up, and if you don't, I punish you. What's the problem is we usually do that to our spouse. You know, you need to clean this up, and if you don't, I'll punish you. But God never appointed us to raise our spouse. He appointed us together to raise our kids. But I do think that this is not the way most people approach marriage. And I mean, parenthood. And this is parenthood. Self-denial, patience, and obedience. That is parenthood, you know. And there's a lot of joy, but this is parenthood. And one of the problems today is that people don't want this to be parenthood. They want to have a life that was just like the life before the kids came. And most of the discipline of kids today is not because we care about the kids, but it's because they embarrassed us, or because they're making our life difficult, or because they don't let us do what we want to do, and just shut up and go to bed, all right? Okay, not because we're concerned about them, and our kids know it, and that's why they don't listen to us, but that's Father Terry's lecture. Any other questions?
When you are upset and you want to, you know, this is your cross, how do you pray and trust God and honor your marriage by honoring God and deny yourself and be obedient when it's something that, like, the other person's view could change on? I mean, truly,
mm-hmm.
Not just that if you said, I'll endure this for the cross, then your mind changes. How do you just give the other person over to God when you are upset like that?
Well, my observation is, and I think that this is confirmed by the tradition, my observation of marriages is the only time our spouses really change is when we give them the freedom not to change. Now, I have seen my wife do things that I never thought she would do because I stopped requiring her to do them. You know, sometimes I just gave up. She's never going to do it. I came home 3 weeks later, she had done it. And I was shocked, you know. She cooked fish for me the other week, you know. I couldn't believe it. After 8 years of telling her she had to cook fish for me and her refusing, I stopped telling her 2 years ago and I got fish. That's a simple example, but it's true. And the same thing's true, because when you back your spouse into the corner and he or she feels controlled, that when we back them into this corner where if you want me to love you, then you better do exactly what I tell you or you're not going to get loved anymore, they don't change. That isn't how God deals with us, is it? I mean, that's how I used to think he dealt when I was a Protestant, but now that I'm Orthodox, I know it's very different, that God loves us. And God motivates us to change by saying, I love you so much, and I always will love you, right? And I think that answers this, is that if we just accept what's in our marriages and accept our spouse and give them the freedom to be the person that God has called them to be rather than the person we want them to be, we will find, you know, and if you got a marriage in which two people are practicing self-denial, patience, and obedience, what a marriage! That's heavenly. Because there's two saints in it, then. Yep.
Having them, allowing them to have the freedom to be who God wants them to be rather than who we want them to be, how do you distinguish allowing, just you just let them be whatever God is in their walk of self-denial showing them to be?
I mean, I think, and it's a hard question sort of to answer in very general terms, but I would say in sort of general sense, what I would think is that we have to, in our marriages, not try to be the spiritual director for our spouse. And that's why it's so important that our marriages be both, that we're in a church in which each of us is receiving spiritual direction. I mean, I really think that that's crucial. Because if we let go, as we should, and give freedom to our marriages, what counterbalances is that we're both submissive to a spiritual father who gives us direction. And I found that in my marriage and in other marriages, the concept of a spiritual father is liberating for marriage. Because we're both not only in submission and obedience to each other, but we're both in submission and obedience to the church. And so there are limits that are set, but I don't have to, you know, sometimes in marriage you get that sense where you're just holding them back, you know? You know what I mean? Just keeping, because if you let go, boy, all bets are off. And if you're within the context of the church, there's those safeguards there. And I think so I don't know if that helps to answer, but that's why marriage has to be, as I said, lived within the context of a community. And we have to get away from this John Wayne idea. Me and my gal. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I have this picture of, you know, you saying, I'm enduring this for Christ. And it becomes a little distorted where it's kind of like the attitude is like almost boastful. How do you get away from, you know, dealing with the attitude of, I'm doing this for Christ, you know?
Right, right.
And getting the right heart attitude about it.
So that's why this cross has to be erected in our... I mean, that's where confession comes in. Because if we find that... I mean, this is why marriage cannot be lived outside of the sacramental life of the church. Because if you find that's happening in you, how do you deal with sin in your life? How do you deal with pride in your life? What do? You go to confession and you confess it. I mean, this is how everything is interconnected. And you receive then counsel from your spiritual father on how to deal with your pride. And that's what I'm saying, is that marriage provides us all these opportunities to do the real spiritual work that we need to do on ourselves. Because if you see that in yourself, then that's something you need to work on. And that's what the sacraments are here for. That's what the priesthood is here for. That's what the church is here for, is to provide us those resources. Yeah.
How much you apply this in a situation where a spouse is doing something very harmful to themselves, such as a substance abuse problem,
right.
Where you're trying to be patient and obedient and deny yourself, but you also see that your spouse is destroying themselves. Maybe you can comment on that.
Yeah, and I mean, there are, as you work through this, and I mean, I'm glad for these questions because I don't ever want to be. I mean, the wonderful thing about our tradition is we understand the complexity of life. And we can teach the ideal, but then we also recognize that that ideal has to be applied within the historic context, and that sometimes that the application of that ideal is difficult. So I'm glad you asked, because that's a hard situation. I mean, and it's very difficult. I feel very frustrated standing up here to give some sort of blanket answer to that, because it's so unique. But clearly, if our spouse is doing something that they are actively hurting themselves, then that's not the issue I'm talking about here in self-denial, obedience, and patience. And at that point, we need to do all that we can to try to help them stop hurting themselves, within the context of understanding we can't control them either. You know, and that's this thing about free will. I really like it, but I hate it, because it means that sometimes I can't make people do the right thing. And I even have to give people the freedom to do the wrong thing and love them. And that hurts probably more than anything else, without participating in their sin. And that's, once again, why these decisions have to be made, and your marriage has to be lived within the context of the larger community, because you can't make those decisions by yourself. And that's why God has given us a community, and that's why God has given us His church. Is that, you know...
Wonderful hidden parts of the
virtues. Hidden parts to the cross.
Yeah.
I don't have them memorized. Let me look back. I've got the cross memorized. I don't do it enough, because I don't know them by heart. Self-denial. So I'll start with patience. From patience comes hope. I mean, yeah, think about James 2. Let's go back to James 1, 2. You know, blessed are you, endured all things. For he who has endured, you know, the joy comes and the hope. But the hope comes from patience, St. Theophan says. Obedience develops love. And from self-denial comes faith, and out of self-denial comes joy. Because the most joyful person in the world is the person who wants nothing. I mean, think about it. If you wanted nothing out of life, you would be so happy. It's true. That's true. I mean, in a deep spiritual sense, just to accept God's will without hidden agendas. Good. Anyone else? Yeah.
Can you talk about submitting to each other? But you didn't talk about the idea of the wife submitting to her husband. And I know in the evangelical world, at least in the Bay Area, there's been a big movement toward mutual submission and erasing this part about wives submitting to their mates or husbands. So can you clarify, that's a big question, I know, but, you know, kind of the boundaries and the foundation for which a wife submits to her husband over or in lieu of or different from mutual submission to each other?
Well, certainly we can't erase the Bible, especially not as Orthodox Christians, because we believe in all of it. And then my second answer is, that would really require a whole other lecture, which I would be willing to give at some point. But what I can do is, I think the best answer to that is to go back and read St. John Chrysostom, as he talks about the way this is understood within the context of marriage. His understanding of submission of the wife, which we believe, but also of loving headship, is so wonderfully balanced. And I'd really suggest, if you want to find it, it's at the back of Father John Meyendorf's book on marriage. Just the part is in there, and you can read that.
So are you saying this is not an Orthodox idea?
That
mutual
that,
submission to each other?
Well, mutual submission, I don't know what the Protestants mean by it, because I've been out of the Protestant world for 4 years, so I don't know what the current terminology means. I don't know, because I haven't read any, I don't know what they mean by that. I would say that the idea that there is no headship in marriage is not a biblical idea. It can't be a biblical idea, and it's certainly not a patristic idea. But I think by that the Protestants are trying to understand freedom. See, the Protestant world suffers from, do I have time to do this? The Protestant world suffers from an inability to relate freedom and authority. So it always, and this is the predestinarian versus the Arminian debate that just continues on all levels, because of the denial, because grace and nature are always seen as being opposed to each other. So the Protestant world oscillates from this rigid authoritarianism to this egalitarianism on the one hand. And it just is always oscillating because it has no doctrine of synergy and because it has no understanding of freedom, and yet freedom not negating authority. I mean, because it has these theological problems, the world, and, you know, I've seen it, you know, it just, when it comes to the issue of the family and role relations, it just goes back and forth and back and forth because it has no theology that can deal with it. Because if you don't have a doctrine of synergy and understand the relationship of God's sovereignty and man's freedom within the context of that doctrine, you're never going to understand the roles of man and women, because men and women play out Christ and His church. And if you don't understand Christ and His church, you're never going to understand the husband and the wife. So, I mean, that's... So I can't... I mean, but so we believe in both. And we don't say that they... And that's why I said read St. John, because it's a wonderful explanation of it. I think it's really helpful. All right, I want to close then with the Synaxarion from... I'm going to try to get through this one without crying. It's short. The Synaxarion from October 9th, my favorite married saints in the whole wide world, Saints Andronicus and Athanasia. And this is what's said in the short little that you read during Matins. On the same day, October 9th, we commemorate our venerable father Andronicus and his wife Athanasia. In asceticism in this world, as well as in the next, Athanasia has remained at the side of Andronicus. Isn't that beautiful? In asceticism, self-denial, patience, and obedience in this world, as well as in enjoying the joys of the next, Athanasia has remained at the side of Andronicus. May God bless you, and may that be said of your marriage. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Today is the frame of the cosmos.